Morning and welcome. My name is Cindy McGuire, and as the President and CEO of Monadnock Community Hospital, it's my pleasure to welcome you this morning to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Dr. Robert Weinberg. Please join me in thanking our musicians today, Festival Chamber Music. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR two Sundays from now at 10 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within the next few days. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, the speaker has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will be collecting your questions toward the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided. Following the program, we invite you to attend an informal reception in the parish hall, which is through the door to your left. There, you will have the opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. As you entered this morning, in your pew, you will find a blue card. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list and/or the email list. You can either mail the blue card to us or drop the blue card in the glass bowls alone or with your contribution to the sustainability of the Monadnock Lyceum. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church or in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support. At this time, I'd like to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Robert Weinberg. He will be discussing the topic, Are We Curing Cancer? Dr. Weinberg received his PhD in biology from Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1969 and has held research positions at the Weizmann Institute and the Salk Institute. In 1982, Dr. Weinberg joined the faculty as a professor of biology at MIT and published his landmark paper, Mechanism of Activation of a Human Oncogene, in the journal Nature. In 1999, another major paper, Creation of Human Tumor Cells with Defined Genetic Elements, was also published in Nature. Dr. Weinberg is a founding member of the Whitehead Institute, located in Cambridge, Mass. Whitehead Institute is a world-renowned nonprofit research institution dedicated to improving human health through basic biomedical research. Dr. Weinberg is a pioneer in cancer research, most widely known for his discoveries of the first human oncogene, a gene that causes normal cells to form tumors, and the first tumor suppressor gene. Dr. Weinberg literally wrote the book on cancer. He authored The Biology of Cancer, which is a textbook used by students studying the molecular and cellular bases of cancer at the undergraduate, graduate, and medical school level. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Weinberg.
Thank you, Ms. McGuire. In fact, my wife and I have been holed up in the woods of Ringe since 1975. My usual garb there is walking around in mud-caked overalls, so this is a refreshing change. actually talking for the first time in my life from a pulpit in a church. No man is a prophet in his own land, but I feel like I violated by being here. The title of my talk today is, Are We Curing Cancer? And what I would prefer to say instead is, how do we reduce the mortality from cancer that we currently experience in this country? And in order to get a background on this issue, we need to really visit the science of cancer epidemiology. That is, how often do different people at different ages sustain cancer? How often do they survive the cancer? How often are they struck down by cancer? And the first and most apparent thing one learns from cancer epidemiology is that cancer is largely a disease of older people, with the exception of breast cancer, which often strikes in middle life. And so, much like Alzheimer's, which also is a disease of aging, cancer is also is known to increase dramatically with increasing age. So that, for example, the chance of a 70-year-old man developing colon cancer is 1,000 times higher than the chance of a 10-year-old boy developing that same disease. And that has important implications for how we think about cancer, because as our population ages, as we get older and older, it's not that any one of us runs an increased risk during our lifetime of getting cancer. Instead, it's that we live long enough to develop the diseases of the aged, including Alzheimer's and cancer. And the implication of that is that as the population increases in its age component, the number of people who are over the age of 65, when cancer first appears in large part, is going to increase. And this will create, in the end, over the next decades, a major public health problem. Again, not because any one of us risks increased exposure to cancer during our own individual lifetime, it's that we live longer. We will be living long enough to develop this disease of the aged. And at present, we don't really have a clear view of how we're going to deal with what could become a public health crisis when 20 or 30 years from now, the number of individuals in our society over the age of 65 or 70 will exceed 50 or 60 million people. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Again, to the extent that many of us think of cancer as being an epidemic, it's not necessarily because there are really more cases in the population than there were before, if one takes into account the aging of the population. It's that we're reaching an age bracket where many of our contemporaries are at an age where they are for the first time running the risk of cancer. There's also a second distorting fact about the incidence of cancer, that is how often it is diagnosed. And that is, these days, increasingly, we are detecting cancers that 20, 50, 100 years ago would have eluded detection. And the individuals bearing these cancers might have reached the age of 80 or 90 without knowing they actually had a cancer of one sort or another. And that has also important implications. For example, last year in this country, about 250,000 cases of breast cancer were diagnosed. That is the incidence of the disease. The number of women who died from breast cancer was 40,000. And the difference between 250 and 40,000 is not due to the brilliance of the oncologists and the surgeons in large part. Instead, it is due to the fact that we're detecting many, many cases of breast cancer, for example, that previously would have escaped detection, and women who would have lived to the age of 80 or 90 without ever knowing they had, as it were, a breast cancer, now are told in midlife that indeed one has been diagnosed. I often have women who come up to me and say, I beat down breast cancer. I survived it. I fought it back. And I won't say, and it should stay in this room or on NHPR, that most of those women, for better or worse, had a form of the disease that earlier would not have killed them anyhow had it never been diagnosed. And that creates a severe problem for us, for the medical profession in general and economically, which is that we are at present over-diagnosing a disease, often treating it aggressively when, by all rights, it should remain undiagnosed and unmolested because it will never develop into a life-threatening condition. To give another example, at the age of 80, if one does autopsies on individuals who died from various causes of disease and so forth, about 80% of men have prostate cancer, but only 3% of men die from prostate cancer. And the numbers are almost identical with breast cancer. And so from this one begins to realize that a critical thing we need to develop at present is not necessarily curing the disease, but figuring out which patients are deserving of aggressive treatments and which should simply be subjected to what is called watchful waiting, which in the great majority of cases will never actually lead to a disease which will threaten life and well-being. Another take-home lesson from what I just told you is that cancer takes a very long time to develop. People who develop cancer at the age of 70 or 80 are probably reaping the consequences of a disease that was developing slowly over the previous 4, 5, or 6 decades. Women who develop breast cancer at the age of 70 may be developing a disease whose inception could be traced back to things that happened to them in their adolescence. And this already begins to suggest that our body is well armored to protect us against the development of cancer. If it were not, we would all be covered with tumors by the age of 2. In other words, the normal human body has an extraordinary number of defenses that have been evolved over the last 500 or 600 million years to protect us from developing various kinds of tumors. I mention that in the context of the following. We humans are very large and very long-lived organisms. We reach the age of 70 or 80. During that time, in our body, we have cells which grow and divide and grow and divide a total of 10 to the 16th times. That means 10 million billion times a cell in our body will grow and divide and grow and divide. And one of the problems with the biology of all animals, not just humans, is the fact that almost all the cells in our bodies are given the license to grow and divide on their own, which obviously makes it possible to maintain tissues, but also renders us susceptible to the danger that one of these cells will become a renegade and go off on its own and begin to multiply to create the flock of descendants, which we realize is an actual clinically detectable tumor. It is indeed a miracle that given these 10 to the 16th cell divisions, we don't get cancer more often. And that reveals the fact that during our evolution from, let's say, simple worms of 600 million years ago to complex mammals of today, not only has there been the evolution of organismic complexity, our complex tissues and functions, but there has been the co-evolution of anti-cancer defense mechanisms that ensure that the appearance of cancer is actually, our perceptions notwithstanding, relatively low in a human lifetime. That having been said, what are the actual statistics of how often people die from cancer these days? Some statistics are encouraging, others are a little bit discouraging. If we look over the last 30 or 40 years, the deaths from stomach cancer, from uterine cancer, colorectal cancer have gone down often dramatically. Deaths from stomach cancer, which used to be the most common cause of death in this country, exceeding all other causes of death, have gone down by as much as 85% over the last 60 or 70 years for reasons we don't totally understand, but maybe due in large part to food storage, refrigeration, and the much maligned food preservatives, which some people believe cause cancer, but as you may sense from what I just said, actually do exactly the opposite. Uterine cancer has gone down dramatically because of the pap smear by at least 75%. Colorectal cancer has also gone down at least 30 to 40%, and is probably to 80% preventable if people use colonoscopy to be diagnosed should they develop the incipient stages of colorectal cancer. So some kinds of cancers have gone down quite dramatically. During the breast cancer epidemic that we heard about 20, 30, 40 years ago, the incidence of breast cancer between, the mortality from breast cancer between 1930 and 1990 was totally flat, not changed by one whit, even though everybody was saying that women were dying right and left from breast cancer. And over the last 15 years, mortality from breast cancer has gone down by 30 to 35%. In other words, the risk of a woman dying from fatal breast cancer has gone down quite significantly, and it continues to go down. We all know that failure is an orphan. Success has many parents, you've heard that. And so who is claiming credit for this dramatic decline in breast cancer mortality? The therapeutic radiologists, the chemical oncologists who delivered chemotherapy, people who supply tamoxifen, cessation of hormone replacement therapy. Actually, the evidence that mammography is responsible for the reduced death rate from breast cancer is very slim, even though everybody feels obliged to have it done. I won't wade into that tempest in a teapot, but it's actually there. So there are some very good signs, indeed, in the case of breast cancer. One also has other agents that have been developed recently, such as Herceptin and tamoxifen, which have proven to be extraordinary in essentially eliminating mortality in subgroups of breast cancer patients who otherwise would have progressed to a lethal disease. Other kinds of diseases have not been so successfully treated. Pancreas cancer has been a killer and remains a killer, and the success rates from treating pancreas cancer are no higher now than they were many years ago. Patients can live comfortable lives a bit longer now with pancreas cancer, but still it represents a disease whose long-term prognosis is indeed grim. Lung cancer mortality has gone down by 30%, but that's not because of the brilliance of the oncologists. Lung cancer is due, as you know, to 90% of it at least, to smoking. And the reason why there's been a dramatic 30% decline in lung cancer-associated mortality among males in this country is not because we really have better ways of treating aggressive lung cancer. It's because people have stopped smoking. In fact, smoking tells us a very interesting lesson, because during World War II, the United States government, in its wisdom, issued with K-rations packets of cigarettes to the troops. And as a consequence, emerging from World War II were millions of men who were addicted to tobacco. And when we began to see the increase in the use of tobacco, exactly 30 years later, there was a parallel uptick in the rate of death from lung cancer. And that, by the way, gives us an interesting metric of how long it takes to develop a cancer from its inception, in this case, almost exactly 30 years. It also says, again, that if we wish to reduce lung cancer mortality, the most important tool, which I will return to later, is not figuring out new ways of treating it, although we surely should continue to try to do so. It's the whole area of prevention. That is to say, preventing people from developing a disease which, in many cases, could become life-threatening in the long run. Indeed, just to preface other things I will say, the most effective way of reducing cancer mortality in our society over the foreseeable decades will not be brilliant new cures that my molecular biologist colleagues will develop. It will be by reducing the incidence of the disease, that is to say, how often the disease develops in the first place. Knowing what we now know about the risk factors for various kinds of cancer, some have estimated that between 60 and 70% of the cancers that we develop in this country could be avoided if we changed our lifestyle. That's a stunning figure. Some even think 80% is the number. And it begins to suggest these preventable causes of cancer which are, by the way, not environmental pollution, which has an almost negligible effect on cancer incidence, except in northern New Jersey, for example, not by, which happens to be the example of poster child of environmental carcinogenesis. It's not because of food preservatives. It's not because of hormones that are fed cattle. There are a number of items in our diet, in our natural red-blooded American diet, which contribute to cancer, none of which are avoided by eating the so-called very popular organic foods, which you might wish to know are good for only one person in terms of your health, the person who's selling them to you. They offer no health benefit whatsoever, as far as anyone can tell. And so if we begin to examine how we could reduce cancer mortality, which I mentioned in passing before, then we need to begin to think of the lifestyles that affect our susceptibility to breast cancer, to colon cancer, to a whole series of diseases. How do we know that these environmental effects are so important? Perhaps the most persuasive effect comes from examining Japanese who live in Osaka, Japan, and Japanese Americans who migrate from Japan to Hawaii, where they live. And what one sees is that within one generation, the stomach cancer, which runs rampant in Japan, almost disappears in Hawaii. Colon cancer, which is almost rare, has been rare in Japan, shoots up just like the European Americans in Hawaii. And a whole series of conditions rapidly changes because of what one imagines are assignable environmental factors. But keep in mind here, when I talk about environment, I'm not talking about the world around us. I'm talking about what we introduce into our bodies through lifestyle changes and largely diet. And therefore, we begin to realize, even though it continues to be a critical goal to reduce various kinds of mortality through the development of new and highly effective anti-cancer drugs, in the long term, our society will not be able to afford to treat the present burden of cancer patients unless we reduce the incidence through relatively dramatic changes in, which we can talk about later, in lifestyle and in large part, diet. At the same time, to state the obvious in terms of economics, we are getting almost to the stage where we can no longer afford to treat all the women who were overdiagnosed with breast cancer. As I suggested before, it could be that 75 to 80% of them are being treated aggressively because we can't distinguish at present between those cases that will one day become life-threatening and those that will remain benign during the life of the patient. At present, we're learning how to do so better and better, and this epidemic of overdiagnosis, which also afflicts prostate cancer patients, will somehow need to be addressed because it's economically inviable for us to continue to treat aggressively every patient who's diagnosed with one or a different type of disease. I wanted to give you some metric of how successful our current ways are of treating cancer, and therefore I just wanted to refer to a table that I recently pulled down to give you an indication that a diagnosis of cancer is more often than not a death sentence. To repeat myself, 250,000 women were diagnosed with breast cancer last year, 40,000 died from it. That's more than less than one in six people diagnosed with breast cancer will ever die from it, just to make it clear. Lung cancer, 220,000 were diagnosed, 155,000 died from it. 75% of those diagnosed with lung cancer eventually died from it. Prostate cancer, which has a very parallel behavior to breast cancer. 160,000 men were diagnosed with breast cancer, or will be diagnosed with breast cancer, this year in the United States. 26,000 will die from it. Here you see a 6-to-1 ratio, where you can begin to intuit that, to a first approximation, 80 to 85% of the cases of prostate cancer that are diagnosed will never lead to a fatal outcome. Colorectal cancer, colon and rectum, 135,000 new cases diagnosed, 50,000 die from it. So I'm telling you these numbers to indicate to you that there's a very high difference, a large difference between the frequency with which we diagnose a certain kind of cancer and the actual death rate. Melanoma of the skin, 87,000 cases will be diagnosed in 2017. 9,000 people will die from melanoma. I'll say that again, 87,000 diagnosed with melanoma, 9,000 will die from it. Another classic case of overdiagnosis, as a cynic has said from Dartmouth Medical School, the melanoma epidemic is a guaranteed full employment act for the dermatologist. And there's, by the way, relatively slim evidence that removing all the melanomas that are diagnosed will actually reduce long-term risk of dying from the disease, current wisdom notwithstanding. And then there's some major successes. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which in previous times was a fatal disease, 70,000 were diagnosed, 20,000 died from it. That's a tribute to chemotherapy and the brilliance of the oncologists. Leukemia, 62,000 people were diagnosed last year, 25,000 died from it. Once again, a testimonial to the brilliance of the oncologists. So they do get to have some credit for some things. Endometrial cancer, 60,000 diagnosed, 10,000 died from it. 6-to-1 ratio. And this is also largely due to intervention in these cases. So given all this, one of my take-home lessons today will be that current perceptions notwithstanding, and to repeat myself, because as you sense, I'm never averse to repeating myself, the big solutions in reducing mortality from cancer over the next generation are not going to come from brilliant new discoveries and treatment. They will come, I say again, from reducing the incidence of the disease to begin with. And you already see that the big elephant in the living room, as it were, in the case of cancer, that is lung cancer, has already gone down by 30% just because people are no longer smoking. And by the way, and in passing, I'd mentioned that smoking causes not only almost all lung cancers, it causes 50% of bladder cancers, and a whole diverse array of tumors in other parts of the body, including even an increased risk of breast cancer in women. So what about strategies for developing new ways of treating cancer that now seem to be possible? In my own career, in my own lifetime, I jumped into this field in the mid-1970s, and in that year, 1975, 1976, a landmark discovery was made at the University of California, San Francisco, which described for the first time a gene which was responsible for creating a cancer cell. And over the ensuing four decades, my colleagues and I have discovered more than 100 such genes that, when damaged within a cell, begin to induce that cell to grow uncontrollably. Implicit in this research is the notion that if we are truly to treat cancer effectively, we really need to understand what drives the unrelenting growth, the multiplication of the cancer cell. And in the early 1970s, we actually had no idea why cancer cells behaved the way they did. Absolutely no idea. I recall a meeting with a rather cynical chemical carcinogenesis expert in the mid-1970s in the UK who said to me, he was on the older side at the time, he said to me, one piece of wisdom, never, ever confuse cancer research with science, which describes the grim state of the disease at the time. Because at the time, it was simply descriptive. This cancer does that, that cancer does something else, this cancer has the following prognosis, and so forth. In other words, one could describe the disease without having any insight whatsoever into the causal forces, the engines that drove the runaway growth of the cancer cell. That has changed. Over the last four decades, we have developed an enormously detailed molecular description of the short circuits that drive cancer cells to grow unrelentingly. We now understand it with enormous precision. Now, all of this work was undertaken in part with the presumption, or the assumption, as you will have it, that if we know more about what drives the unrelenting growth of cancer cells, we will be able to develop new kinds of treatments to shut down the engine inside the cancer cell that causes the cell to develop into a life-threatening malignancy. We need to understand, as we now do, the motive forces behind the behavior of these renegade cells. And now we already have begun to harvest some of the benefits of this, but the benefits still are, relatively speaking, rather meager. Chronic myelogenous leukemia, which invariably was a fatal disease 30, 20 years ago, now essentially has been rendered a chronic disease through this kind of molecular research. In other words, individuals can expect to live 10, 20, 30 years without symptoms, having chronic myelogenous leukemia because of a drug that was developed directly from this kind of molecular research. Similarly, the disease of myeloma, which happens also in older ages, used to be a death sentence, but these days, this cancer of the bone marrow, of the antibody-producing cells in the bone marrow, these days, in the great majority of patients, myeloma can be kept under control for many, many years. Note, by the way, that I say kept under control, because in both of these instances, one does not describe a cure, one describes converting a life-threatening disease into a chronic disease that is that proceeds without any symptoms, but must be kept under control by certain kinds of drugs. And in fact, that has been the goal for many kinds of contemporary cancer research. Can we convert a life-threatening disease to a chronic disease which can be kept under control for decades without interfering with the lifestyle, with the health of the patients who suffer from this disease? By the way, I would be remiss if I did not mention in passing brilliant successes in treating certain pediatric cancer, acute myelogenous, acute lymphocytic leukemia in young kids used to be a death sentence. And these days, 70 to 80% of the kids are actually cured of the disease. That's quite stunning. What I might mention in passing is that the chemotherapy that succeeds brilliantly in eliminating the disease may also leave behind some lifelong cognitive defects, problems with the children, or even cardiac defects we don't really understand. So much of these treatments, especially chemotherapy, represent a double-edged sword. I'd also like to make the following point, and that is each year we're making incremental improvements in treating different kinds of cancers, and that puts the whole discussion in a different light, because people sometimes ask me, when are we going to cure cancer? And I have to remind them that cancer is in effect 120 different diseases, unlike heart disease, which is one or two. Coronary artery disease has been successfully fought with different kinds of therapies that have reduced deaths from heart attack by 60% in our society. That's quite impressive. But heart disease is a simple disease compared with cancer. Not only are there 120 different kinds of cancers, each individual's cancer behaves a little bit differently from every other individual's cancer. Different individuals respond differently to different sorts of treatments. And so the war on cancer is not going to be won through one major victorious battle. It will almost certainly be won through a whole series of skirmishes where we progressively reduce the mortality from disease one decade after the next. I can imagine, for example, that the 30 to 35% reduction in mortality from breast cancer, which is a very real and significant achievement, will continue, and that in 5 years, maybe one will have reduced breast cancer mortality down to 50% of those who were diagnosed with what would otherwise be a fatal condition. So it will be a series of skirmishes, not one highly significant battle where everybody on the enemy on the field is all totally vanquished. People upon hearing that ask me, well, why with all these molecular explanations have you not done better? Or they will say, why don't you just talk to the other scientists, you cancer researchers, hide your light under a bush. You don't talk. If you just talked to one another more often and collaborated, things would go much faster. And the truth, for better or worse, is that doing cancer research involves incessant chatter worldwide with other cancer researchers. People like myself tragically have to jump on airplanes all the time to report our findings to colleagues across the world, and they come here. We publish our findings in research journals, which describe in excruciating detail the different advances that we've made, and we collaborate when there are opportunities for collaboration. And so the usual explanation for why cancer research has not succeeded more rapidly in developing new kinds of treatments, I can tell you, has nothing to do with the fact that cancer researchers are averse to talking with one another or collaborating with one another. It's simply due to the fact that this disease is vastly more complex than we imagined it would be when the first molecular and genetic analyses of cancer were undertaken and succeeding in 1975, 1976. There are highly targeted therapies which have been developed over the last decade, many of them inspired by examining the genes inside cancer cells, identifying genes that have undergone mutation and damage and are responsible for the runaway proliferation of the cancer cell. And there have been drugs that have been targeted to shut down those genes and their mechanisms of action. And sure enough, in the great majority of cases, people who are treated with these targeted agents, given the fact that their tumor cells bear these mutant genes and malfunctioning proteins, such patients respond for 6, 8, 10, 12 months. They respond dramatically. But what happens almost invariably is that the disease comes back 10 or 12 months later, rears its head once again, necessitating perhaps a second-line therapy, necessitating a new type of targeted therapy, and that is a problem we have not yet solved successfully. Cancer is a wily foe, highly evasive. It's like a chameleon, always changing its colors, always attempting to escape different kinds of therapies that have been directed its way. One very hopeful sign has been the development over the last 5 years of dramatically new forms of immunotherapy, which involve implicitly harnessing the immune system in order to attack and eliminate cancer cells. Until about 5 years ago, if you would have asked me, what about immunobiologists and their attack on cancer cells, I would have said, perhaps in even less polite forms, that they were all charlatans because they were a lot of smoke and no fire. They were talking a lot about how the immune system could be harnessed to eliminate cancer, but until that time, nothing really had happened. But over the last 5 years, there have been dramatic advances that have allowed dramatic cures of melanomas, for example, and certain kinds of solid tumors. This provides the hope that if one can harness the immune system, which has been evolved to detect generally infectious organisms, such as bacteria and viruses, we can also direct the immune system's anger and killing effects towards tumor cells. And indeed, this seems to be a viable approach whose utility in terms of treating all kinds of currently available, currently diagnosed cancers is yet to be proven. Even here, there's the possibility of escape, of evasion by tumor cells, but to my mind, immunotherapy at present holds the greatest promise for eventually, as it's optimized over the next decade, eventually providing us ways of eliminating various kinds of cancers. The truth is that cancer cells sense they're being surveilled by the immune system, normally developing tumors in the body. Tumors that develop in many individuals already develop evasive strategies to enable them to fly under the immunological radar and escape detection by the immune system. And we are just now learning about these evasive maneuvers of cancer cells and how to thwart them so as to render the cancer cells susceptible to attack and elimination by the immune system. At present, to my mind, this holds great promise, and we'll have to see how that develops. And on that dramatic note, I'd like to thank you for your attention and for inviting me to preach from a pulpit.
Thank you, Dr. Weinberg, very much for that informative discussion. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking the first question. First, thank you for informing us about the current treatments and advancements in a very complex health matter, cancer, which many of us are touched by either personally or as in our family members. You have discussed advancements in treatment, and today there seems to be a lot of emphasis on patient-specific genetic testing and then using patient-specific testing to design treatment considered to be individualized for that patient. Can you discuss the impact of that and where you see that in the future?
The patient-specific testing involves taking a patient's cancer cells, examining the DNA and thus the mutant genes inside the cancer cells, and designing a targeted therapy that will specifically strike that mutant gene that is responsible for the runaway growth of the cancer cells, as I described before. The fact is that such targeted therapies turn out to be useful for maybe 10 or 15% of cancer patients, hardly for everyone. And thus, this technology has been a bit oversold, to say the least. In those individuals who benefit from such targeted therapy and who initially respond, as I said before also, their responses are often observed between 6, 9, 12 months, after which the cancer comes back. It has evolved into a new type of subtype of cancer that is no longer responsive to the initially applied agent, and where one needs to provide, as it is said, new forms of secondary therapy. And whether one will continue to be playing these hit and run games with rapidly evolving cancer cells, we cannot know. But I can say that this personalized medicine is very good for a minority of patients, but hardly the great majority that are seen in the oncology clinic.
Thank you. Given the average age of the room, most of us here already have incipient concerns. What lifestyle changes, if any, should we be making to slow these cancers down? I'm sorry.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I can actually answer it. The fact is that I, too, am at that age. We all were once younger than springtime, but most of us can no longer say that about ourselves. Obviously, implicit in that question is my statement that cancer begins over many decades' time. But there's also the wisdom that the rapidity with which cancer progresses and evolves to a clinically presentable and detectable disease can be influenced by lifestyle. What are the factors that increase cancer risk? Well, one factor in a woman is parity, how many children she has born, whether or not she, and at what age she has born them. Body mass index turns out to be, after tobacco, the second most important determinant of cancer risk for reasons that we don't totally understand. As an example, women who have a high body mass index have a fourfold higher risk of developing ovarian cancer. That's not a minor change. And there's at least a dozen cancers for males and a dozen for females whose mortality is affected by body mass index. So staying slim, as essentially everybody is doing in this room, essentially, is something that would be very wise to think about. As I often tell my students, You shouldn't smoke, and if you live with parents who smoke, throw them out of the house. Obviously, tobacco doesn't even need to be discussed. Getting exercise for reasons we don't understand seems to reduce the mortality from various kinds of cancer. And changing diet. Diet seems to have a profound effect on the resurgence of, for example, colorectal cancer. There's one study, which I've never seen repeated, by the way, where two groups of patients were treated for colorectal cancer surgery. Half went back to their healthy, robust American diet, and the other half went into a so-called Mediterranean diet. And within several years, the relapse rate among the patients who had returned to their American diet was, I believe, three or four times higher than those who went over to a Mediterranean diet. It wasn't a subtle difference, and from this you can begin to understand that the diets of our children and our children's children are likely going to change dramatically compared with what we and our ancestors ate. I would indeed say that it's never too late to change one's diet, since you've asked, away from a diet that's high in fats, high in red meats, high in processed meats, low in green vegetables, low in fruits, to one which is much more vegetarian and allows one to reduce, not eliminate, the risk of developing various kinds of cancers. It's ultimately a numbers game. Nothing is guaranteed, but one can shift the playing field in one way or another by changing one's diet and one's lifestyle. And staying out of the sun without sunscreen, to state the obvious. Now we have all these tanning parlors where the young ladies like to develop keratosis and melanomas by going under these machines. Needless to say, this doesn't make that much sense.
Thank you, thank you. 10 to the 14th divisions of each cell.
But 10 to the 16th, yes.
Oh, 16th, okay. But we don't grow billions of times bigger. Please discuss the relationship between cancer and cell death issues.
So I told you that we, our cells, divide 10 to the 16th times in a lifetime. And I think every minute, I may be wrong about this number, there are 10 million cells that divide and an equal number that die. Because the process of eliminating cells is as critical, obviously, as the process of allowing them to divide. And in biology, one calls this homeostasis. As I often say, why use a simple Anglo-Saxon term when you can use a fancy Greek term? Homeostasis means that there's a perfect balance between how many cells are allowed to proliferate and how many are eliminated. And this leads to an imbalance when cancer forms, because in the case of cancer, cells are allowed to proliferate, but they're not killed at an equal rate. And that's what leads to the net number of increased cells in the body, which we see as a tumor.
Thank you very much. What are your thoughts about how to reduce overdiagnosis? For-profit interests are making a lot of money on this overdiagnosis and treatment.
So there seems to be a subtle political or economic agenda there. Not being a clinician, I won't go too far in that direction. But the fact is there's an enormous amount of research at present that's pursuing how to develop new kinds of diagnostic and prognostic markers that can allow one to tell, for example, which woman's breast cancer has the plausibility of eventually becoming aggressive and which ones are highly unlikely to be aggressive. Already a decade ago in the Netherlands, there was a test devised by a former postdoc of mine who was able to segment breast cancer patients in the Netherlands into two groups. 50% of women for whom there was a plausibility of some advanced malignancy developing, and 50% of the women for whom treating the disease aggressively represented a greater risk than the risk of that woman ever developing life-threatening disease. So already there, one could divide these women into two groups, but I would think over the next decade, we want to divide breast cancer patients into maybe 80% who don't need aggressive treatment and 20% who do. That's a rapidly developing area with improvements coming along literally every week.
Thank you. Why is it so difficult to distinguish between benign and aggressive cancers?
Well, in fact, it's not difficult to distinguish between benign and aggressive cancers. The difficulty comes from being able to prognosticate, being able to prophesy into the future as to which benign cancers will eventually become malignant. We know for sure that all malignant cancers derive ultimately from benign precursors. About that, there's no doubt. But if you find a benign tumor, then you have to make the difficult diagnosis. This tumor has the possibility of eventually evolving into an aggressive disease, and that tumor has a very unlikely possibility of doing so. And as I say, we're gradually learning how to be able to do that. Just to add one addendum to that, in the case of colonoscopy, which I would urge you all to participate in, even though I'm not a member of the colonoscopy lobby, the fact is that if you have a colonoscopy done and polyps are removed, that can reduce the risk of developing colorectal carcinoma by as much as 80%. That's not a minor benefit. Mammography, I don't know. But colonoscopy is clear. It's clearly beneficial.
Are you in favor of changing guidelines for screening breast cancer at later ages?
That's yet another tempest which I will not wade into. It's very complicated, and I don't have the expertise to really speak in an authoritative fashion. The only thing I will say there is irrelevant, which is, well, it's not really even relevant. I was about to say the reason why academic disputes are so nasty and bitter is that the stakes are so low. But this is much more than an academic dispute. Here the stakes are actually pretty high. But I will tell you that there really is very credible evidence that the benefit from mammography is relatively minimal. To put it another way, it's not obvious that women who've undergone mammography with certain frequencies and at certain ages have a lowered risk of mortality from breast cancer. Obviously, there will be diagnostic radiologists, of whom there are probably several in the audience, who will take exception to what I just said, in the same way that there may be dermatologists in the audience who will tell me that the melanoma epidemic is far more than a full employment act for their profession.
You spoke of the lack of evidence for food preservatives in developing cancer that are organically grown. Foods have no difference from conventionally grown and processed foods. Are you suggesting that there is no evidence of the role of herbicides and pesticides in developing cancer?
The evidence for herbicides and pesticides contributing to cancer is very strong in the case of agricultural workers who are exposed to enormously high doses of these agents. There's no doubt there. But if you look at the trace amounts of these herbicides and pesticides that may be present in minute amounts in our food chain, the evidence that they actually have any effect is almost zero. It is zero, I would say.
You mentioned the Japanese and Hawaiians. What caused the difference between the Japanese and Hawaiians?
This is a complicated issue. The big difference, obviously, is that Japanese Americans assumed the American lifestyle. And amusingly, in Japan, they have increasingly adopted a westernized diet. And as they have done so over the last two, three decades, diabetes has shot up, heart disease has shot up. Was that a diabetologist in the background there? and so have different kinds of cancer. Exactly why all the factors that contribute to the westernization of the Hawaiian Americans and their significantly changed cancer incidence when they moved to Hawaii, it's not all clear. It may be that they're exposed to different kinds of bacteria that inhabit the gut. It certainly is the case they're embracing the so-called healthy red-blooded American diet, which we already realize is extraordinarily unhealthy. And maybe there's other things that contribute. I don't have the full catalog of factors. But it tells you one very important thing, which I didn't say explicitly. The rates of cancer in these individuals are not due to inheritance of genetic susceptibilities to cancer. I didn't say that clearly, as I should have, because the same people who live in Osaka and their children and grandchildren who live in Honolulu have dramatically different rates of cancer, which indicates that it's their surroundings, not their genetics, their inheritance, which dictates susceptibility to disease.
Discuss what legislation is taking place in conjunction with cancer institutes to lower cancer drug treatment costs.
This is yet another area I will not wade into. The fact of the matter is it's extraordinarily expensive to develop different kinds of cancer drugs. The other thing to be said is that we sell cancer drugs at a much higher cost in this country than across the world, which breeds the argument, not incorrectly, that the American taxpayer is shouldering the costs for treating the world as a whole. That having been said, I really don't find I have the expertise to describe how that could happen. And in any case, as you may be vaguely aware, the whole economics of healthcare in this country are all up in the air. Nobody knows what will happen or where the new initiatives will come from.
Thank you. We have time for one more question. Some believe cancer is caused by a virus. What are your thoughts?
In fact, about 20% of cancer in the world is caused by viral infections. 99% of cervical carcinoma is caused by human papillomavirus, HPV. So cervical cancer is an infectious disease almost always. Epstein-Barr virus causes different kinds of lymphomas in Africa. The increasing rate of liver cancer in this country is due to infections by hepatitis B and hepatitis C virus. And if you sum all of those three kinds of viral infections together, about 20% of the total cancer burden in the world comes from these viral infections. We can now vaccinate against at least one of the two hepatitis viruses, perhaps both. We can certainly protect young kids against developing cervical cancer by vaccinating them against human papillomavirus, HPV. So there are some hopeful signs that these kinds of diseases, at least in our society, are actually preventable, because they are, at least two of the kinds, are actually preventable through vaccination, which, by the way, also has lost favor in the eyes of some in this country who strongly embrace organic foods and eating granola, but disapprove of vaccination. Go figure.
Thank you again, Dr. Weinberg, for sharing your time. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at monadnocklyceum.org. And stay up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook. The program next Sunday will feature Barbara Rendles, author of her recently acclaimed book, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, The Story of Coretta Scott King. Thank you again, Dr. Weinberg, for a wonderful talk, and thank you all so much for coming today and making possible this lively dialogue. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank Roger Swain for the beautiful flowers. Roger is a hybridizer of at least two of the varieties of daylilies that you see in the arrangement. Thank you, Roger. Now please join us in the parish hall and enjoy some refreshments, which have been generously provided by the Hancock Inn and Fox Tavern and the Hancock Market. If you have a question that was not answered during the program, please feel free to ask it during the reception. We'd like to hear from you about your experience today, and we encourage you to fill out the blue card and add your name to our email list on the clipboard available at the reception.